Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the most important domesticated animal? When we celebrate dogs, horses, and cattle, it's easy to overlook chickens. We've brought these tough little animals with us just about everywhere on the planet for use on our tables, in medicine, as a source of income, and even religious inspiration. As my guest today will explain, chickens are in fact much smarter and more historically significant than we give them credit for. Andrew Lawler is a contributing writer for Science magazine and contributing editor for Archaeology magazine. His new book is called Why Did the Chicken Cross the World? The Epic Saga of the Bird That Powers Civilization. Andrew, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
You came to this topic rather reluctantly at first, but then once you got started investigating the intersection of human history and chickens, you couldn't stop.
I did indeed. I told the editor, I don't do livestock, when he suggested that I do a story about chickens, because I've primarily been writing about science and archaeology topics, but I did get hooked pretty quickly.
What makes the chicken such a fascinating thing to study?
Well, partly it's that it has been so ill-studied. We know so little about the chicken, and that's what surprised me when I set out to find out, okay, how did the chicken spread around the globe? I realized that very little has been written about it, and there's no popular study of the bird that covers the millennia with which it's been one of our most important companions.
And for a long time, even archaeologists who would like dig up ancient sites would sort of not worry so much about what people had been eating.
Yeah, chicken bones were not very high on the list of what archaeologists used to look for. They were interested in finding written texts or, you know, beautiful objects that would end up in museums. But gradually over the years, they began to realize that what people ate can tell us as much, if not more, about people who lived in the past than the texts that they wrote.
What is the wild origin of the chickens that we have cultivated and probably completely changed in the modern world?
Well, as most people know, the dog comes from the wolf, but the chicken comes from an animal that most of us have never even heard of. It's called the red jungle fowl. And the red jungle fowl is a very shy and very sly bird that lives in bamboo thickets across South Asia. So all the way from Pakistan to Indonesia, the bird lives in a very kind of quiet way. It's not seen very often. And as a result, it was long considered to be a prime bird to try and hunt because it is so difficult and so clever.
And certain cultures throughout history have seen chickens as sacred.
Yes, this is something that surprised me quite a bit, that the bird actually only till recently was seen primarily as a religious and an entertainment animal. So in the beginning, people began to use the chicken for religious sacrifice. And the chickens are fairly small, and killing a cow could be, you know, very, very expensive. But chickens are a little bit easier to handle. So they became a really key part of sacrifices in religions all around the world.
And was it their holy value that caused people to bring them to new places initially?
Well, this is one of the big questions. And the surprise that I found out was that most researchers now believe that the chicken was spread initially not because of its meat and not because of its eggs. It was spread primarily for cockfighting, which in the beginning probably had religious significance, much like bullfighting, for example, in Spain, began as a religious ritual. Likewise, cockfighting was used for religious purposes and then gradually became more of an entertainment, something that people would do to pass the time in that age before television and the internet.
Is religion a legitimate justification for cockfighting as it's practiced anywhere in the world today?
Well, justification is a strong word, but the Supreme Court certainly believes so, because they agreed in the early 1990s that people who practice chicken sacrifice for religious purposes, they should be protected. They should be allowed to practice this because of freedom of religion. So that was a very big landmark case that revolved around sacrificing chickens.
Why do roosters want to fight each other if you put them together?
Well, actually, the red jungle fowl is not a big fighter. If it's cornered, it will fight. It's a very tenacious animal. But really, it's humans that have bred these birds to be particularly fierce. And over the millennia, since the chicken has been domesticated for many thousands of years, people have been able to breed them to be quite fierce once they're put in the ring with another one of their species.
So how did chickens, I mean, initially it was kind of a big investment to own a chicken, to raise a chicken. Chicken wasn't a cheap meal that people thought they would have several times a week.
No, not at all. It's only in the past 50 years that really that chicken has become a cheap commodity for meat and eggs. In the past, it was served lots of purposes. We haven't mentioned medicine. For example, if you've had your flu shot this season, that came from a chicken egg. Chicken eggs have been used for a long time, not just for flu vaccine, but also for scientific research, going all the way back to Aristotle. So for at least 2,500 years, the chicken and the egg have been an important model for science and for medicine as well.
What is it about the structure of the egg and what's contained within it that makes it such an ideal medium for growing particular substances?
Well, the beauty of the chicken egg is that it's a size where you can cut a little hole in it and you can watch a bird develop. You can actually watch the embryo develop. And Aristotle was doing this in ancient Greece. It's something that researchers still turn to in order to understand evolution and understand the nature of embryonic development. It's been a very important model for scientists around the world through many ages.
Chickens were also a really important livestock animal for Americans kept in slavery. This is a fascinating component of the book.
It sure is, because I started to dig around. I was curious, well, how did the chicken get to be such an important bird in the United States? Because when the settlers first came here, there were lots of other birds. There was the turkey, of course, as well as all the birds that Europeans brought with them. But there were so many wild birds, wild ducks. Why would people choose chicken? And when I began to dig around, I discovered that some scholars have done some work in this area, and they found out that the chicken actually, at the beginning, in the 1600s, in the Virginia and Plymouth colonies on the East Coast, had actually used the chicken quite a bit when they first arrived. But pretty quickly, ducks and turkeys took over. That's why we eat turkey on Thanksgiving generally. But as time went by, the slaves in the American South began to use the chicken, began to grow chickens. And because whites didn't consider chickens to be all that important, they were allowed to grow and raise chickens and then actually sell them to the white slave owners.
So not only did that cause a proliferation, I guess, of chickens on American tables, but it gave at least some black families kept in slavery a source of income.
Yeah, absolutely. It was really the only way that most slaves, particularly in the colonial era, could ever think about spreading their entrepreneurial wings, so to speak. And they did begin to get money, which they were able to use and to trade with one another, trade chickens back and forth with one another for different kinds of goods. It became this whole underground economy that gradually surfaced in the form, in a kind of a surprising form, because, of course, a lot of black women were cooking for their white masters, and they had an economic incentive to encourage those masters to eat more chicken. So as a result, the chicken became increasingly popular in the American South among the white gentry, and then that spread. And fried chicken, which is primarily a West African dish, which comes from the places where most African Americans were taken from, that became an incredibly popular dish in the South, and then, of course, spread around the country and now around the world. It's a quintessential American dish, and the foundation of that clearly comes from the work of African Americans.
And I didn't also realize that for a long time, raising chickens was thought to be women's work, right? Egg money was this big deal for people.
Absolutely. Most white farmers, male farmers, believe that, you know, real men don't raise chickens. They have cattle or they have pigs. They don't mess around with chickens. And chickens were an animal that were generally kept close to the house, so you could throw your scraps out the back door and they would eat them. They would recycle your family waste. So they were very useful animals for the women who were running the household generally. But for the men, they weren't seen as something that could actually provide an income. But for women, it proved to be very, very important. Both white and black women, particularly in the South, as well as in the Midwest, were able to make money, make some egg money by selling primarily eggs to the cities that were beginning to grow rapidly in the industrial North.
And then in the United States, when during the World Wars, things like hogs and cattle were rationed for average consumers, chickens were still more available as a meat source.
Yeah, chickens weren't considered to be an important meat source. If you had chickens on your farm, you used them for eggs, and if the hens got too old, then, well, you put it in a pot and you stewed it up, but it wasn't going to be very, very tender. So it really wasn't until after World War I that people began to consider the chicken as a primarily as a meat source. That's when the broiler business began, and it was a woman, a farm woman who lived in Delaware, who came up with the idea. She accidentally was sent 5,000 chickens instead of the 50 she had ordered, and she didn't know what to do with them. So she raised them in a shed that she had and sold them to New York and made a fortune. And then she bought more. So that was the beginning of the broiler business. That was back in the mid-1920s.
How much fatter are the chickens we buy today than the chickens you could get at the early part of the 20th century?
Well, if you ask your grandmother or your great-grandmother, they probably can remember the chicken before it became the very large creature that it is today. Most chickens, say 50 or 100 years ago, were pretty scrawny. They were primarily bred to mainly for eggs or for cockfighting. So they had a build that was built for those purposes rather than to provide this giant breast. So chickens today are maybe twice as big as the chickens that our great-grandparents ate.
Is there an obvious difference between rooster meat and hen meat?
That's a really good question. Well, roosters have a reputation for being a little stringier, and that's probably because they were doing a lot more work around the barnyard trying to protect the hens. So they would be running around, and as a result, they would have more muscle than fat, whereas the hens tended to stay, say, closer to the back door where the scraps were thrown. But I think that if all things being equal, if hens and roosters were living the same kind of life, you're not going to find much difference in that meat.
And these days, of course, they are, particularly in industrial farm settings, right? They're all pretty tightly caged.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you have the broilers, who are those are the chickens that are bred primarily for their meat, and then you have layers. Both of them are housed generally in cages. The broilers, though, are often kept in very, very large, vast sheds. So they aren't cages per se, but a lot of scientists are very concerned that when you put chickens with those large numbers into these vast warehouses, they actually don't treat each other very well. The social system, the pecking order that's so famous that chickens have, breaks down once you get above, say, 50 or 100 chickens.
So they're so stressed that they might abuse one another.
Yes, absolutely.
So I was really surprised. The term that you use in this book is legal invisibility of chickens. Under federal law, chickens raised as food are not even considered animals?
Yeah, this surprised me. I'm a science writer, and I really didn't know much about agricultural laws in the country. So when I began to dig around, I discovered that under federal law, if chickens are kept for food purposes, that is, if they are bred to be eaten, then they don't count as animals. So if you're raising a chicken, say, to use for scientific research, which there are quite a few, or if you have a chicken in, say, in a circus, they are protected. But the chickens that we actually buy in the supermarket are not even considered to be living creatures.
Andrew Lawler is my guest. He's a contributing writer for Science Magazine and contributing editor for Archaeology Magazine. His new book is called Why Did the Chicken Cross the World? The Epic Saga of the Bird That Powers Civilization. We welcome your calls, maybe your stories about experiences with chickens. You can do it at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for THINK comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Andrew Lawler, a contributing writer for Science Magazine and contributing editor for Archaeology Magazine. His new book is called Why Did the Chicken Cross the World? The Epic Saga of the Bird That Powers Civilization. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Andrew, tell us more about the living conditions that the birds that either produce our eggs or that we eat as meat tend to experience in this country.
Well, I was curious about what scientists have to say about how the chickens actually feel when they are in their cages or in their warehouses. And so I went to a Michigan State University where a scientist is doing research on hens that live in cages. And what she's doing is fascinating because she's looking at different ways of caging birds and seeing what their stress levels are. And what she did was she found out that the Department of Defense had this neural net, this net that they could put on soldiers to detect exactly what their heart rate is, whether their stress levels are increasing or decreasing, really what's going on physiologically, which is very important for the military to know. So she adapted this technology to chickens, and she's beginning to actually put these nets onto chickens in order to find out how they actually feel. When are they stressed? When are they not stressed? And this kind of basic research really is quite new, and very few people have done this kind of work. I think it's very important because we might feel better if we think chickens are in better conditions. But my question is, are the chickens feeling better? That's what's really important.
Right. So what looks okay to us may not make any difference for the chickens.
Right. For example, free-range chickens, she argues based on her research that when chickens are allowed to roam around in large numbers, they don't always use their freedom wisely. That, again, when you get to these large numbers, their system breaks down and the birds can actually attack one another and they can be even more miserable than they are in a very small cage. Doesn't mean that small cages are better. They're looking at something in between these enrich cages that have very simple little devices like perches that can allow the birds at least to have a minimum of their natural habitat so they can live a little bit more like they might in the wild, although of course it's nothing like being in the wild, and chickens actually don't survive very long in the wild, but a little bit more like the chickens might design it themselves if they could form a committee and decide exactly how they would want to be caged if they didn't have another option.
What would the natural lifespan of a chicken be if it were protected and not eaten at any point?
Well, of course, most broilers that you will buy in the supermarket have only lived, say, 6 or 8 weeks. But a chicken can live for up to 20 years or even longer. They actually can have very long life cycles. It depends on the breed. You have very small bantams that don't live very long. You have very large chickens that have longer life cycles. So, but what's funny is that it's very, very difficult today to see an old chicken because they tend not to live very long.
These days, there are a lot of people in the sort of backyard chicken movement, and I would think that the growth of that as a hobby, if you want to call it that, would cause more people to be interested in the living conditions of chickens.
Yeah, I think there are people who I've said the backyard chicken movement is fascinating. It's not the first time we've had that. We had a backyard chicken movement back in the 1840s when Chinese chickens were introduced to the United States, and people began to collect them, and they became this. It became an incredible hobby that people were willing to pay thousands of dollars for these exotic chickens. In World War I, people were encouraged by the government to raise chickens so that they would have eggs to eat. And that the soldiers could eat the pork and beef that went abroad, and the same for World War II. So we're in maybe the fourth period where chickens have become immensely popular, and I think it's a great way for people to actually see how their food is made. You know, how does an egg come into being? Most children who live in cities have never even seen a live chicken. So I think it's a wonderful way for people to get a little bit closer to their food source.
What do you know about the laws recently enacted in California that require better conditions for chickens sold there as food?
Well, the researcher I mentioned in Michigan, I asked her about this because in California, as of January 1st, chickens that are hen-laying can no longer be held in these small cages. And her feeling was a little ambivalent. She said while she understands and she certainly wants chickens to live in under better conditions, she's not sure that the research is clear whether or not allowing chickens to roam more freely will make them happier chickens. We might be happier consumers because we think we're doing the right thing, but it's not clear yet whether those laws really will increase the way chickens understand their level of happiness or not.
You know, it's funny. There are all kinds of jokes about people being bird-brained or whatever. Chickens are not necessarily thought to be this bright animal, but it turns out they have cognitive capacities that we might not have imagined a few decades ago.
Yeah, this idea of birds being stupid really is a new idea. It's not till the 1920s that came about the same time that chickens began to be mass-produced. Essentially, they became this item that wasn't seen as particularly important or certainly not intelligent. And the truth is that the chickens actually are surprisingly smart. I went to visit a researcher in Italy who's been doing some very simple behavioral experiments with chickens. And he showed me a couple of experiments he'd done. They were very simple ones involving 3- and 4-day-old chicks. And he said, you know, we have evidence that their logical capacities sometimes are greater than those of my own graduate students. And, you know, he was only half joking because chickens were able to remember things. They were able to make choices with very little prompting. They were able to show that they understood mathematics. You know, they could add and subtract. This is pretty surprising because I think most of us think that chickens don't have much in between their ears, but clearly they do.
Do chickens have, you mentioned pecking order, and so there's, you know, someone at the top and someone at the bottom. What's the ideal size of a little chicken flock?
Well, going back to the Romans believed that the ancient Romans loved chickens. They used chickens for everything. They used them for medicine. They used them for religious purposes. They never would go to war without consulting the sacred chickens first. And they also did like roast chicken. So they believed that the ideal chicken flock was, say, around 50 or so. And up until up until World War II, that was about the size of the average flock in the United States, that for the most part, over time, chickens have been in that range, which is probably a little bit larger than you would find the red jungle fowl living in South Asia. But nevertheless, it's very close. You know, a couple of dozen to, say, 50 chickens is kind of ideal for their society.
So if we are looking to buy responsibly, is it possible to go to a store and look for small flock chicken? That's not a thing yet, is it?
This is such a hard question. I get so many questions about this, and it's really a problem because we don't really have standards. We as consumers have a really hard time knowing what we're getting. Should I buy that cage-free egg that's more expensive? Is it worth it? Am I really choosing an egg that comes from a chicken that was treated better than one that was caged? These are very hard decisions. And what I think would be very useful is if we had some really simple standards so that we could decide if I want to pay more for a chicken that's treated better, I can make that decision, but that I know that chicken's treated better. At this point, really, we don't have a lot of standards. Cage-free can be misleading at times when it comes to say, hormone-free, well, hormones have never been used in chickens, or not for the past 50 years. Antibiotic-free, yes, that's coming into play now. But what I would like to see is a really simple way for consumers to be able to make choices, because right now you really don't know what you're getting.
What's in the feed that they're given?
Well, up until a couple of years ago, actually, arsenic was commonly used in feed for chickens because it increased their appetite and killed off certain kinds of bacteria in their systems. The FDA recently said no to that and suggested that that's not a good idea. So feed today is a little bit better than it used to be, and antibiotic use is on the decline because of concerns that we use antibiotics for animals, then we're going to create bugs that that could hurt humans because those antibiotics won't be effective for us. It's a controversial subject, but I think everyone agrees that it would be good to move away from mass use of antibiotics purely to get chickens to grow faster. So it's a really difficult question. Now, how are we going to treat chickens well and have the standards so consumers can make good choices and still have the kind of cheap chicken that people are used to?
Well, that's the thing, right? We want cheap meat, but then in recent years we've had some serious incidents in which chickens and other domesticated fowl seem to be responsible for the spread of some pretty serious pathogens among human populations.
Yeah, in fact, the Europeans think that the way we process chickens is not very safe, and so they forbid the import of all American chicken to Europe. Now, partly that's for competitive reasons, but partly is because the way that chickens are processed in this country, is somewhat problematic. But, I have great faith in the American system. I believe that we can find a way to process chickens not just in a safe way from a health point of view, but also to do it in a way that respects the chicken so the chickens don't suffer needlessly during the course of their lives or during slaughter, and at the same time have chickens that aren't terribly expensive. I don't think we have to trade things off. I think we can come up with new ways of doing this that can provide an out to a very difficult problem.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. Vicky in Allen says, my mother referred to stewing chickens and frying chickens. Is there still such a distinction, and what is it?
Stewing chickens and frying chickens. Well, I want to make sure that you understand that in my book, I don't have any recipes.
Right.
There are enough books about chicken recipes. But certainly stewing chickens was a traditional way of dealing with the fact that most chickens were old, that when a chicken was no longer laying, when a hen no longer was laying eggs or the rooster could no longer crow, it was time for the pot. And that meant stewing it, because if you stew it for a long time, that very, very tough meat will become a little more tender. So traditionally, stewing chicken was pretty common. Now people don't do it as much because we have a chicken that is fairly lean and fairly tender and also quite bland, by the way. That's a price we paid for that kind of chicken.
What did Charles Darwin make of chickens?
Well, I went to the Natural History Museum in London. And when I arrived and talked to the curator, she looked at me and she said, no one comes to see Darwin's chickens. they all come to see his finches. So Darwin was fascinated because I mentioned earlier that in the 1840s, there was this what was called the fancy. It was a time when Chinese chickens arrived into England and into the U.S. as well. And Darwin became fascinated when he realized that chickens are so diverse. And so he wrote to people all over the world and had chickens sent from everywhere in the world and began to examine their skeletal structures in order to understand exactly how it is that chickens could be so diverse over so many continents. And in doing so, although he didn't write much about them in the Origin of the Species, he drew on that research in order to understand exactly what was happening and where the chicken originally came from. Because back then, people were debating what was the origin of the chicken. And it was Darwin was one of the first who said the red jungle fowl is clearly the sole progenitor, is the sole ancestor, that all chickens that we see today come from this one very shy bird that lives in these bamboo patches in South Asia.
Of course, that bird, could it fly?
Well, I went to Vietnam to try and see red jungle fowl in the wild, which turns out to be a really difficult thing. And as I was sitting behind a screen of bamboo trying to be very quiet, and the local guide was rolling his eyes because I'm a city boy and I was not being quiet enough, we stayed up there for a few hours and we heard the crow of these wild red jungle fowl, which sound almost identical to the crow of a domesticated bird. So you're there in the jungle, in the mountainous jungle, and you're hearing these crows. It's very odd. When I went back down to where the Land Rover was parked, one of the people that had come with me, a Chinese biologist, said, oh, you should have been down here. We just saw two red jungle fowl fly across that rice paddy there. So actually, the wild birds, if they have to fly, they will, and they can long distances. But mostly they like to be on the ground, kind of like pheasants. They're a pheasant-like bird.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to David in Frisco. Hi, David.
Hi, Chris. Very interesting topic. Actually, our family's involved in some cattle raising, and I've often considered, I think that mammals maybe get a little bit more attention on the humane scale and in the eyes of some consumers, first of all, such as maybe a whale or a dolphin might have more of an empathetic view from the consumer or from an observer than would a fish. But I can tell you that in the course of just observing, once I saw sheds in the pasture, small confinement sheds that were used for raising calves, and I'll use the term loosely, raising calves in a confined environment for veal. And having seen our cattle raising open and so forth, I was completely appalled. And I think the same thing sometimes about the aspect of poultry, in this case chickens. You know, it's almost like a commodity. What's the price of gasoline today? What's the price of chicken? It's ubiquitous. It's hard to go through the day in many regards or through the week without engaging some form of retail purchase of chicken as a food animal. And I just wonder how that empathy level is compared against mammalian-type food animals.
That's really interesting. Thanks so much for your call, David.
Yes, I think the caller is right that you look at the terms. Cattle make beef, pigs make pork, chicken, well, chicken's chicken. That even in the way we use our language, we betray the fact that we see this bird as a commodity. And what I discovered in the course of my research is that for most of human history, the bird was seen very, very differently. For example, I mentioned ancient Rome. In ancient Rome, the chicken was considered to be an animal that had it had a connection to the gods because it could maybe not fly, but it could kind of jump up and down. It was a bird, and birds were considered to be animals that had a special relationship with the gods. And you know, this is something that sounds a little odd today, but it's still true. I went to Bali, and in Bali, people there would never think about doing a religious ritual without first killing a chicken. And you're right, mammals kind of get all of the glory, but it's chickens that have done a lot of the hard work for us.
Andrew Lawler is with us. His new book is called Why Did the Chicken Cross the World? The Epic Saga of the Bird That Powers Civilization. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, featuring the SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning with classroom instruction, a CFP board-registered curriculum, and flexible class schedules. Applications are being accepted for the program, which begins January 20th at SMU in Plano, smu.edu/CPFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Andrew Lawler, a contributing writer for Science Magazine and contributing editor for Archaeology Magazine. He's also author of a new book called Why Did the Chicken Cross the World? The Epic Saga of the Bird That Powers Civilization. Join us by emailing think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. We have Kim on the phone now in Tyler. Hi, Kim.
Hello.
Hi.
My question is the breast size that the Americans, like the bigger chicken breasts, that the chicken's legs, can they even support it? I've seen evidence that they've gotten so big that their little legs can't support it. And also, if they're under stress, doesn't that release stress hormones into the meat, and then we then consume stress hormones?
What do you know about that, Andrew?
Well, thanks for the question, Kim. Yes, the chicken that you get in the supermarket today, almost every chicken that you could buy in the supermarket today is from the Chicken of Tomorrow contest that took place around 1950. And that contest was designed to create a chicken with an enormous breast that would feed the American public. And the chickens that we have today are all designed in order to have the largest amount of breast meat possible because Americans favor white meat. And as a result, you're right, the skeletal structure of the chicken often can't bear the weight of that breast. And if you compare the chicken that you get in the supermarket, if you could see one in one of the industrial facilities, and you look at the chickens from, say, 50 or 100 years ago, there's a vast difference. You can tell that they look a little uncomfortable and misshapen, and that is a direct result of what industry has done to provide consumers with very, very cheap chicken.
Compared with other meat animals, and I'm thinking about large mammals like pigs and cattle, in terms of calorie in for calorie out, are chickens more efficient to grow for human food than other animals?
Yes, absolutely. Compared to cattle or pigs, in fact, the only animal that is more efficient at turning grain into meat is the salmon, than farm salmon. But other than that, the chicken is remarkably efficient in converting those grains into meat. It's astonishing what science has done in the past 50 years with the chicken. Of course, the flip side of that is that in doing so, we've created this bird with these physiological troubles. We've also created vast amounts of waste, which are very hard to deal with. So while on the one hand, the chicken is the most engineered creature in the world, in world history, and it is a triumph primarily of American engineering and agricultural science, we also have created a monster in a way in trying to deal with the after effects of doing that.
You feel like we owe it to chickens to do better by them, even if we're going to slaughter them at the end of their lives?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that's a... You know, that's a basic human trait. We want to have gratitude for that which feeds us, and that can take many forms. But when I realized that the chicken had played such and still plays a very large role in many religions around the world, I started to think, makes me a little uncomfortable as somebody who was raised eating those large chicken breasts that are relatively inexpensive without thinking much about the bird. It made me a little uncomfortable, and my goal in doing this research is to really uncover that lost history so that people can have this deeper appreciation for the bird that goes well beyond whether breast meat is $1.99 today at the store.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Roy on the line in Rockwall. Hello, Roy.
Hello. Yes, I have a question about chicken manure. I have a big garden, and I've been tilling their manure into the garden right now in anticipation of planting in the spring. That's not going to cause any problems, is it?
Well, as you probably know, chicken manure is very, very acidic, so it usually has to be cut with other material so that it doesn't actually burn organic material. And this is why chicken manure is such an issue, because if you just spread it on soil, it often can do as much harm as good. So it has to be leavened with other material. So be careful how much you use.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also email think@kera.org. Nicole from Dallas writes to ask about your insights or observations regarding the chicken industry as it relates to common and exotic chicken feathers used in things like millinery, fashion design, and costuming.
Well, back in the 1870s and 1880s, the fashion began for women to wear hats that had exotic feathers in them. And actually, this is what led to the creation of the Audubon Society by a couple of society women in Boston who became upset about this because they realized that birds were being wiped out all around the world. And the birds that were most affected were pheasants. And the chicken is a kind of pheasant. So the red jungle fowl, for example, was hunted by people across South Asia in order to decorate the hats of women who were walking around in New York and San Francisco and probably Dallas. So it's that has been a long-standing issue. And the pheasants, because pheasants have the most beautiful feathers of any birds in the world, the red jungle fowl and by extension its cousin, the chicken, have been targets of that kind of use. And that goes back a long, long way. Feathers have been an important part of, you know, human culture in terms of decoration for a long, long time.
Back to the phones now. We have David on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, David.
Hi, good afternoon.
I go right ahead, please.
A timely discussion because my wife and I were just at the market picking out groceries, and we always try to pick organically fed, free range, you know, and the price difference is significant. I mean, it's really $6 versus a buck for the cheapest eggs.
Yeah.
I had to laugh when you guys were talking about this because I don't know if you've watched the program Portlandia where there's an episode where they go in and they want to know how happy the chicken was, and so they decide to go visit the farm before they eat, and they want to know the chicken's name and all these things. And I just wonder, are you saying there's no empirical evidence whatsoever that says that the health of the humans that consume these eggs are the difference between free-range, organically fed, versus just the 99-cent parton?
Well, this is where our definitions get a little foggy. Organically fed simply means that they are fed organic grain, so they can be in very, very, very small cages or in large numbers in a vast warehouse and be organically fed. That doesn't say anything about their quality of life. Nor does free range, because free range technically only means that there's essentially a little porch outside of a vast warehouse and a little door they can go through. I'm talking about industrial operations now. And for the most part, why would chickens want to go outside? Because the food is inside. Plus, there is a danger, because if they go outside, particularly if they're younger, their immune systems aren't equipped to handle the bacteria they might encounter, and they could actually get sick and infect the whole flock. So we've created a system that's very difficult to get out of. So free range doesn't get us off the hook. There are a few small companies that are doing chickens in using a European method in the way they're raised and in the way they're processed. And from what I can make out, that system seems to work quite well. And while the chicken is more expensive, it's not outrageously so. So it might be something one can only do on special occasions. But I think you can, you know, do a little research and find out exactly what kind of chicken do you want. And if you can find a local supplier and pay a visit, then great. I think that's great to know your food source.
This book made me think a lot about all of the colorful expressions that chickens have contributed to our language. Do you have some favorites?
I think most of my favorites have to do with cockfighting, because, you know, cockfighting, of course, is so reviled now and it's against the law in the U.S., but it's still so embedded in our language, and it hints at how important that sport was for so many thousands of years. I mean, think of the term battle royale. That is a term used for when many chickens are put together in a pen to fight, or to show pluck, or if you want to remain cocky. You know, the pilot is flying a plane from the cockpit. The Globe Theater, by the way, theater in the round that Shakespeare used for his plays, actually was designed for cockfighting. So I think it's rather interesting that this sport, which now is largely gone, although you'll still find it across the American South, it's still very popular in some places, that it's still in our language. So the importance of the chicken really remains in our language in a way that goes way beyond the cheap meat we're used to.
You saw a cockfight in your research for this book?
I saw many. I went to the Super Bowl of cockfights. I'd never been to a cockfight, so I thought I might as well go for the biggest one of all. And that takes place in Manila in January, and it's called the World Slasher Cup. And they have several hundred cockfights that take place over a five-day period. And this happens in this enormous coliseum with big screens. So if you're sitting up in the rafters, you can see up close and personal as the roosters go after each other. And it's very popular there. And also, it's very, very legal.
Was it hard to sort of unlatch yourself from your American understanding of this sport? I'm going to assume that you are not, generally speaking, a supporter of cockfighting.
No, but I came to it with a lot of trepidation. And I was also very curious, because it's something that I automatically assumed is a terrible thing. And it's something that I don't want to be involved with personally, but I wanted to go and see for myself, because it's a very important part of understanding the history of the chicken. You cannot understand why and how the chicken became domesticated and why and how it reached our plates without understanding cockfighting, because that is the way that the chicken was transported around the world, and that was one of the primary ways. So I went there with that kind of curiosity, and I don't need to go back.
Are chickens raised for cockfighting? I mean, do they – listen, I'm not making a justification here, but do they have a better life before they're actually put into the ring than other chickens might?
Well, in the Philippines, it's incredible. These chickens are living a life while they're alive of incredible luxury compared to any other chicken on earth. They live in air-conditioned stalls. Sometimes they have piped-in music. They're fed very well. They have their own cages. They're treated with great care and love by their handlers. I was in Venezuela visiting a slum in outside of Caracas where there was a man who raised cocks, and you know, this is not a big operation, but he was so devoted to it, and many generations of his family had raised cocks. So it helped me to see this other side of it, that yes, it's a blood sport in which animals are pitted against each other, and there's an incredible brutality to that. And these people who raise these animals are very, very proud of what they do and feel like it's an ancient tradition, like, say, bullfighting, that deserves respect. And they do seem to treat the birds with respect, at least until they go into the ring.
If we go quickly here, we have time for one more call, and that's Chris in North Richland Hills. Hello, Chris.
Hi there. I have a quick comment and question concerning the way chickens and other livestock are raised today. And I think we all know that chickens are raised the way they are for corporate profits. Sometimes it's referred to as factory farming. And my wife and I, we do eat organic completely. And there is a difference in the look of a yolk, the taste of a yolk on an egg, and the taste of a white breast chicken meat if you get the right kind of organic foods. And I wondered in your research, did you see anything regarding how chickens are being raised today and its effect on the health of humans?
On the health of humans?
That's what he said, yes.
Yes. Thanks, Chris. Well, the health of humans. There have not been enough studies done to show whether or not eating organic chicken actually has great advantages over eating inorganic chicken. So I don't think we can really say. And I think we want to be clear. There are two issues here. One is the welfare of the bird, which has nothing to do with a bird that is raised organically, right? And the taste of the bird and what goes into the bird for health purposes. Yeah, but there are really three things you're choosing when you pick that chicken out of the bin. And it's hard to untangle these things, but I think that's why I think we need to have really, really clear standards so that we consumers can make that decision ourselves and have the choice. Because in other countries, people do have a choice in what kind of chickens they eat. And I would like to see us have choice in our chickens, too.
May I ask if your diet these days includes eggs and chicken?
Oh, I was afraid you would ask that.
and well, I've given you only 30 seconds to answer. I apologize.
Oh, that's good. So it'll be brief. Well, I am more conscious now when I pick a chicken out. And I try to choose chicken when I buy it at a store. I try to choose chicken that comes from a place where I know they are treating the chickens better and where I know the chicken will actually taste better, because chicken actually tastes great. But we are so used to this bland American chicken that we've forgotten, you know, how good it can be. So I'm trying to be more aware, but there are moments when I lapse and I'm hungry and I will reach for that cheap chicken taco. I will admit it. I'm not proud of it, but that's part of the conundrum we Americans are in today.
Andrew Lawler is a contributing writer for Science Magazine and contributing editor for Archaeology Magazine. His new book is called Why Did the Chicken Cross the World? The Epic Saga of the Bird That Powers Civilization. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Thanks, Chris. It was a pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Christina Martinez. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.